Since April of 1985, this is the DX Audio Service. National Radio
Club. Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for April 2013. This is issue number 338. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 Mackenzie Drive, Mackenzie, Lima, Ohio, 45805. Email for general inquiries goes to Fred Vobey at FVOBBE at realoldiesradio.com. Fred's telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. and Canadian members is now $30, and the magazine is now published on CDs. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to Fred at the address I just mentioned. Or log on to our website, www.nrcdxas.org. And sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get the DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is just $15. Just point the browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. Remember, subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone's assistance.
This is the AM Switch.
Welcome to the April 2013 edition of AM Switch. This is volume 80, number 22 and 23. We begin with call letter changes. Only a few to report this month. 980 WBZK, York, South Carolina, is now WULR. 1000 kilohertz, WBZR, Robertsdale, Alabama, changes calls to WDXZ. And 1290 WMCS Greenfield, Wisconsin becomes WZTI. On the air, 1000 KTOK Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Their CP for U4, 5800 watts day and night, is on the air. 1190 KDYA Vallejo, California. A CP for D3, 3000 watts now on. 1340 KFMD, Bethel Heights, Arkansas, CP for new station, U1, 1,000 watts, day and night, is on the air. Applications for construction permits, 970 KCFO, Tulsa, Oklahoma, amends their pending application to simplify the day pattern from 6 towers down to 2. 1400 WBIZ Eau Claire, Wisconsin, granted a CP for U1, 970 watts, day and night, from a new tower. 1510 KLLB West Jordan, Utah, applies for CP for U1, 10,000 watts day, 260 watts night, dropping their 1,000 watts critical hours power. Construction permits granted, 650 WSRO Ashland, Massachusetts, granted a CP for U4, 1,500 watts day, 100 watts at night. 980 WHAW Lost Creek, West Virginia, granted a CP to move to a new tower. 1260 WISO Ponce, Puerto Rico, granted a CP for U1, 2,500 watts day, 2,000 watts night. This replaces an expired construction permit with the same parameters. 1340 KJMU Sand Springs, Oklahoma, granted a CP for U1, 500 watts day, 1,000 watts night, from a new site. 1400 WBIZ Eau Claire, Wisconsin, granted a CP for U1, 970 watts from a new tower. And 1510 KSPA Ontario, California, granted a CP for U4, 10,000 watts day, 6,000 watts night. Special Temporary Authority, 620 KTAR Phoenix, Arizona, applies for STA to operate without antenna pattern sampling system while the system is being repaired. 740 KRMG Tulsa, Oklahoma, granted STA for night pattern at variance or reduced power. 860 WAEC Atlanta, Georgia, granted STA with day parameters at variance. 910 WRNL Richmond, Virginia, granted STA for U1, 5,000 watts day, 250 at night during tower repair. 1010 WFGW Black Mountain, North Carolina, applies for STA for U1, 12,500 watts day, 125 watts night from a temporary site. They've been operating this way since 2007, but inadvertently let their old STA lapse. 1400 WBIZO Clear, Wisconsin, granted a CP for U1, 970 watts from new tower. 1380 KJUA Cheyenne, Wyoming, granted STA to move temporarily to a new site after losing their licensed site. 1470 KYYW Abilene, Texas, granted STA for U1, 5,000 watts day, 250 night due to pattern problems. 1520 WWKB Buffalo, New York, granted STA for pattern at variance because of phaser problems. 1540 WBRY Woodbury, Tennessee, applies to operate the station under STA even though the license expired when the FCC didn't process the payment with the license renewal. And 1630 KRND Fox Farm, Wyoming, granted STA for U1, 1700 watts day, 1000 watts night, moving temporarily to a new location after losing their licensed site. Silent STAs and silent station notifications. 620 KIGS Hanford, California, applies to extend their silent STA. They've been off since July 31st after the owner's death. 830 KMUL Farwell, Texas, granted a silent STA extension. They've been off since May 1st while looking for a buyer. 890 WHJA Laurel, Mississippi, applies to extend their silent STA. They've also been off since May of last year while awaiting sale of the station. 1000 WDXZ Robertsdale, Alabama, applies for an extension of their silent STA. They've been off since August 16th, but expects to have new equipment installed and be back on the air in March, they said. 1470 WEVG Evergreen, Alabama, applies for silent STA. They've been off since February 2nd due to flood damage. 1560 WMBH Joplin, Missouri, notified the FCC of silent status on February 26th as a new licensee takes over the station, then lost the transmitter site. They're hoping to be on the air from a temporary site soon. And finally, 1570 WFTU Riverhead, New York, applies for silent STA. They've been off since February 20th for a comprehensive technical overhaul. And some Canadian news via Sean Axelrod, Dan Seiss, and Andy Reid of the World Radio TV Handbook. 540 CBEF Windsor, Ontario, is now silent, having completed the move to 1550 kilohertz. 580 CKUA Edmonton, Alberta, will go silent this spring as the station doesn't have funds to update the AM transmitter. 920 CBQI Tulita, Northwest Territories, this LPRT applies to move to 100.9 FM. 1240 CFLM Latuk, Quebec, has moved to FM. The AM is now off the air. 1450 CBKE Fort Chipewyan, Alberta, LPRT applies to move to 99.9 FM. And 1510 CKOT Tillinsburg, Ontario, Canada's last daytimer, signed off for the last time February 17th. The cost of the station's operation didn't justify continuing it as a relay of CJDL 107.3 FM. Well, that's a short AM switch for April. Actually, a good thing for me because I apparently caught Fred's cold. Let's go to Mark Durenberger with this month's Band Scan.
Hey, thanks, Dave, and hello, all. As threatened last month, we're here with the concluding chapter in a fascinating report by Carl D. Forth on DXing from Chicago. An article that recently appeared in DX News called Clear Channel Stories from Boston to Boise, 540 to 1580. He's scanning the dial and sharing his recollections on what the channels once sounded like. Carl's story, aided from the sound of it by his excellent memory and meticulous logs. On the Mexican Clear 900, CHML in Hamilton is the dominant station, along with XCW in Mexico City. The daytimers with lower powered night operations are not showing up here in Chicago. This can be a good sunset or sunrise frequency and is similar in character to 730 because it sounds like it did in past years. On 940, CBM in Montreal was the strong station and was the first Canadian station heard on this Mexican and Canadian clear. Since CBC left the AM band here, CINW was heard, but they in turn left the air in January 2010. Nearby WFAW in Fort Atkinson won nighttime authorization and is usually heard here with a fair signal. Sometimes CJGX from Yorkton, Saskatchewan is heard, along with Des Moines, Iowa, now KPSZ. XCQ in Mexico City was sometimes heard in the 70s. Fresno and Tucson were also heard. This frequency still sports a mix of large and small stations at night. On 1000 in the 70s, WCFL in Chicago, the closest station with its three towers only a few miles from where I grew up. And I spent many days listening to their Top 40 format in the late 60s and early 70s. They were one of the last big clears to have a Monday morning silent period, extending at least into the 80s. On Monday morning, KTOK in Oklahoma City would come up, sometimes with XEOY in Mexico City and rarely Como in Seattle. One of my best catches came here when I heard WHWB in Rutland, Vermont, signing on just before WCFL one April morning. 1000, of course, is now all sports WMVP, but I'll always think of this station as CFL. At 1010, the Mexican-Canadian clear was never a good DX frequency because of my proximity to WMVP. For a while, MVP's IBOC locked out anything else, but they've turned it off, and CFRB in Toronto and WINS in New York, which used to dominate on Monday mornings, and sometimes CBR in Calgary, could be heard. Toronto and New York are still the most common. 1020, by most measures, KDKA in Pittsburgh was the first U.S. broadcast station. Maybe. KDKA still delivers a strong, clear signal as they did in the 70s. During KDKA's silent period, it was possible to hear KSWS in Roswell, New Mexico, now KCKN, and KGBS in Los Angeles, now 10Q. A Colombian and a Venezuelan were sometimes also heard on Monday mornings. There are now more than 20 stations on 1020. One notch up the dial, Boston's 1030 WBZ, another pioneer station, still delivers a good signal to Chicago. It's one of the most distant clears heard here with a dependable signal, and about the last station from New England that can be regularly heard. KTWO in Casper, Wyoming could be heard Monday mornings along with XEQR in Mexico City. Today there are some 25 U.S. stations on 1030, compared to three in the early 70s. One of our locals, WNVR in Vernon Hills, is trying to get low-power night authorization for this frequency. If so, it would be the end of good reception of WBZ. On 1040, WHO in Des Moines was and is the dominant station. They had a Sunday morning silent period, but I don't remember hearing much else on this frequency. A Colombian, Radio Tropical, was often heard during an aurora. Today, the only exotic signal is East Indian programming, heard sometimes after sunset from Atlanta. 25 stations now on 1040. 1050. Some years ago, we used to get Chum in Toronto and WHN, now WEPN in New York, and sometimes XEG in Monterey in the evenings. This was also a good sunrise frequency. There are about 50 former U.S. daytimers here that now have night authorization. One is WLIP in nearby Kenosha, Wisconsin, and they're the strongest signal day and night, though not strong after sunset. I still get CHUM sometimes in the evenings, and the French language signal from CKSB near Winnipeg is heard every now and then. 1060 is an interesting DX frequency, with Florida, Arizona, and Alberta all possible in the 70s. Chicago's old KYW call, now in Philadelphia after stopping in Cleveland, still is the dominant with its all-news format. But WLNO in New Orleans is sometimes heard, as is Radio Educacion in Mexico City. KYW, though, is one of the stronger East Coast signals. On 1070, WIBC in Indianapolis, now sports programmed WFNI, and WTSO in Madison dueled for dominance on this frequency in Chicago. CHLK in Sarnia is sometimes heard in the evenings. KHMO in Hannibal, Missouri, often heard around sunset. KNX in Los Angeles could be heard late at night in the 70s, and you might be lucky and hear CBA in Moncton, New Brunswick at Sinon. I'd like to get an ultralight log of KNX, but no luck so far. 1080 KRLD in Dallas and WTIC in Hartford were the strongest nighttime signals, with WKLO in Louisville sometimes heard in the 70s. There used to be two semi-local daytimers in Pontiac, Illinois, and Valparaiso, Indiana. Now there's one local, WNWI in Oak Lawn, Illinois, with ethnic programming. Their transmitter is down south, but they still pretty much take this frequency out. You can still get Dallas, but Hartford is difficult. Remember 1090 KAAY in Little Rock and their Top 40 format, and before that, KTHS? And there was the wonderful late-night Beaker Street program, one of the first album rock shows. KAY put up a strong signal in the Midwest. They're still the dominant with their religious format, but not as strong as they used to be. Monday mornings would sometimes produce XCPRS in Tijuana, WBAL in Baltimore, and occasionally Panama. I never heard Seattle here, but others in the Midwest did. 1100 WTAM in Cleveland puts out a clear, strong signal, as they did when they were WKYC in the early 70s and 3WE and WCKY, I think. Actually, their signal seems stronger today. On Monday mornings, you could hear KREX in Grand Junction, Colorado, now KNZZ, and KFAX in San Francisco, even, if conditions were good. A Colombian was also often heard here alone on a Monday morning. 1110 KFAB Omaha, WBT in Charlotte used to be the nighttime dominance, and this could be a good sunset frequency with a number of southern stations. Today, it's mostly KFAB at night. On 1120 KMOX in St. Louis, one of the stronger Midwestern clear channels, their broadcasts of Cardinals baseball were a regular visitor on warm summer nights. During their Monday silent period, you could sometimes hear KPNW in Eugene, Oregon. Today, there are 20 stations here. 1130 is loaded with high-powered stations and complicated antenna arrays. At night, there were many powerful stations, but no clear dominant in the Chicago area. WISN in Milwaukee was the daytime guy here, but barely heard at night. KWKH in Shreveport, on top at sunset, and WNEW, now WBBR in New York, was often heard at night. CKWX in Vancouver would sometimes be heard, and KWKH and WBBR today are the dominants. 1140 WRVA in Richmond continues to deliver a strong signal with its directional array. There are several small stations from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and Pekin, Illinois, audible at sunrise and sunset. During WRVA's silent periods in the early 70s, there were many interesting targets, including KRAK in Sacramento, now KHTK, KGEM in Boise, and KLUC in Las Vegas, now KYDZ. The latter two were the first stations from those two hard-to-hear states in my logbook. 1160 Country Music WJJD in Chicago, a 50,000-watt local with a nearby transmitter in the 70s, but they went off the air at Salt Lake City sunset, leaving KSL to fade in later in the evening. After a few changes, WYLL is now the local, and they're 24 hours with a religious format. After WYLL moved their night transmitter site to the southwest suburbs, KSL can be heard in WYLL's Null, and there are a few other stations here at night I haven't been able to identify through the local, including many eastern targets. The frequency of 1160 has about 25 stations now. 1170 was dominated by three in the early 70s, KVOO, now KFAQ in Tulsa, WWVA in Wheeling, and KSTT, now KJOC in Davenport, Iowa. A strong Colombian was also heard, especially later in the 70s. Tulsa's KFAQ is the answer to the question about the strongest nighttime signal on this frequency. On 1180, WHAM in Rochester was the big boy then and now. We have a semi-local WSQR in Sycamore, Illinois during the day. I remember trying for KFOI in Kalispell, Montana many times during WHAM's Sunday morning silent period, before Eureka finally getting them. The Voice of America could sometimes be heard from Florida in the 70s. This transmitter was later used for Radio Marti broadcasts to Cuba and for VOA Creole programs. Haven't heard this one in a while and unsure of its current status. During a recent trip to Florida, only Cuba was heard on 1180. A Dominican Republic station was also heard during the WHAM silent period in the 70s. There were three stations then, now there are 20. 1190, WoWo and Fort Wayne had a different pattern and stronger signal in the 70s before they were bought by a New York station and had their signal reduced. They're still the strongest here, could be a good sunrise and sunset frequency, however, and KLIF in Dallas was heard Monday mornings. Later, KEX in Portland and CHTN in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island were heard. A new St. Louis station, KQQZ, started nighttime service in early 2010. I have a powerful local station on 1200, but WOAI in San Antonio actually seems stronger than when they were the only station in North America here. How can this be? New WRTO is actually in Chicago, but their transmitter is some 30 miles away and the null angle is right on San Antonio. They also moved their transmitter to a different site on the far south side in 2009, and so they aren't quite as strong at my location. WOAI seems to be putting in a better signal than they used to, but I don't know why. There are 25 other stations on 1200 now. We used to get Spanish here in the 70s, but it was from Venezuela in South America, not the south side of Chicago. 1210 WPHT in Philadelphia, then WCAU, was and is dominant here, but never with as strong a signal as Philadelphia's KYW. Also, KGYN in Guymon, Oklahoma, can still be heard sometimes at night. 25 stations listed today on 1210. At 1220, it's Cleveland's WGAR, now WHKW. They had a loud signal in the 70s, but not as strong now. Cleveland's WTAM 1100 signal seems stronger than this one. They also used to be a great sunset channel, but it seems more of a jumble now. Maybe too many nighttime signals on 1220. At 1500, KSTP in St. Paul and WTOP, now WFED in Washington, have always been the two nighttime strong stations. This can be a good sunrise and sunset channel. Despite my proximity to WOPA 1490 and their transmitter on top of the Oak Park Arms Hotel, during an Aurora XERH in Mexico City could be heard in the 70s. Once, when both KSTP and WTOP were off on a Monday morning, CKAY in Duncan, British Columbia was heard. Canada has since left this frequency. 1510, another Nashville favorite, WLAC, still dominant at night. In the early 70s, I remember the evening R&B show with soulful voice John R. and the Ernie's Record Mart ads. WLAC's silent period sometimes produced WMEX, now WWZN in Boston, or KGA in Spokane, Washington. This could be a good sunset frequency, especially to Texas and the Mid-South. An unlikely trio of stations from disparate locations dominated 1520 in the 70s, KOMA, now KOKC in Oklahoma City, WKBW in Buffalo, now WWKB, and KMPL in Sykeston, Missouri, now KRHW, were often heard. Buffalo hasn't been heard here recently. Sometimes another station unidentified would slip in at sunset or during the evening. Cincinnati's WCKY is still the dominant on 1530 here in Chicago. During their Monday silent period, you could sometimes hear KFBK in Sacramento or KCHY in Cheyenne, Wyoming. This was also a good sunset frequency and a good frequency for tests and frequency checks for some reason. Local WJJG in Elmhurst came on the air as a daytimer in 1974, still signs off with the Star Spangled Banner. 1540 is listed as a Bahamas Clear ZNS1 in Nassau. It could be heard only during the Monday morning silent period of KXEL in Waterloo, Iowa. WPTR in Albany was sometimes heard on Monday mornings also. KXEL is still dominant, with stations from Texas sometimes coming in at sunset. I recently heard China Radio International here from CHIN in Toronto. 1550 is one of the best overall DX frequencies. It was possible to hear many stations at different times. No clear dominant station on this Mexican clear channel. CBE in Windsor, Ontario, which recently left the air, came closest. KKHI, now KFRC in San Francisco, could be heard if conditions were right. Now the unlikely big boy at night is WDLR in Delaware, Ohio, with a Spanish-Mexican format. KLFJ in Springfield, Missouri, also heard with its Branson area travel information. The Cuban Clear 1560 was also a very good sunrise and sunset frequency with many targets. WDXR, now WPAD in Paducah, Kentucky. WQXR, now WQEW in New York. They were primary, with KPMC, now KNZR in Bakersfield, California, sometimes heard. These were 70s catches. Today, WQEW's Radio Disney is the strongest signal most nights, with KGOW in Bel Air, Texas, often strong at sunset. One Monday morning in 1973, the first DX test I arranged, KDDA in Dumas, Arkansas, was heard coast to coast on a wide open frequency. One of the most famous border blasters occupied the Mexican Clear Channel 1570. This frequency was dominated at night by English language broadcasts from 250,000-watt XERF in Cuadricuna, Mexico, across the Rio Grande from Del Rio, Texas. Also, CHLO in St. Thomas, Ontario, and CKLM in Montreal were heard at night. This was also a very good sunrise and sunset frequency. This channel is now a jumble at night with no clear dominant. The Cuadricuna station is heard here, but in Spanish and at lower power than the border blaster days. Our last channel, 1580, possibly the best DX frequency on medium wave. It was possible to receive almost every station in North America broadcasting on this channel. CBJ in Chicoutimi, Quebec was the most consistent signal on the Canadian Clear, though not really strong. KLOU in Lake Charles, Louisiana would show up in an aurora. Otherwise, it was possible to log dozens of stations at sunrise and sunset in 15-minute intervals, all the way to KTUF, now KMIK in Tempe, Arizona. The new evening dominant here is CKDO in Oshawa, Ontario. And that interesting and fascinating report called Clear Channel Stories from Boston to Boise in 540 to 1580 was written by Carl D. Forth and published in EDXN News. You heard it here in two parts. And my voice is just about gone from reading that great article. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. We'll see you in 30 days, hopefully with full voice. If you haven't yet done so, please be sure to register early for the combined convention the first weekend in August. We want you to be there to share in this historic opportunity to meet and greet fellow DXers from other clubs who share our hobby. Until we meet you in August or see you here next month, good listening, DXers. All radio.
Book of Records. Landecker looks back on legendary career. This article was written by Robert Fetter in the Chicago Media Blog on March 13, 2013. No radio star in America burned more brightly in the 1970s than John Records Landecker. But after reading his stunningly candid new memoir, Records Truly Is My Middle Name, it's a wonder the guy didn't just burn out. If the alcohol, cocaine, and other drugs didn't kill him, then his four wives, all the other women in his life, or the maniacal managers he worked for probably could have. Happily for all of us, Landecker is alive and well at 65 and still on the radio today, hosting evenings at WLSFM 94.7, occupying the same air shift and uttering the same call letters he did when he first took Chicago by storm in 1972. It's a fitting time for Landecker to look back on his long and influential career, along with more than 30 friends and colleagues who contributed their insights and recollections to this splendidly, thoroughly engaging memoir. The story begins with his arrival in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where his parents prophetically chose his mother's maiden name Records as his middle name. They had no way of knowing that their son would become a radio disc jockey, or that this name they had chosen would become my unlikely calling card, he writes. But if that didn't foretell his destiny, by the time young John set up a pretend radio station in his bedroom closet, this precocious baby boomer's future was set. Those early years at 50,000-watt WLSAM 890 were a magical time for Landecker and for millions, yes, millions, of devoted listeners all over the country. While still in his 20s, he elevated top radio to performance art each night with his quick wit, high energy, and rapid-fire style, honing such trademark bits as Boogie Check and Americana Panorama. See for yourself. There's an award-winning documentary on YouTube about Landecker, Studio A, a profile of a disc jockey produced in 1977 by James R. Martin. He also inspired a generation to follow, including a kid from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, named Jonathan Brandemeyer, who not only emulated Landecker, but went around impersonating him in bars to score free drinks. He just didn't talk, Brandemeyer recalls. He had this rhythm in his voice. If Larry Lujak showed us all that it was okay to be yourself on the air, John Records showed us not to forget the showbiz. Records was showbiz. He worked the music. He talked in rhythm with the music on the beats. He became a part of the song. There was no better radio guy. Pure Top 40 energy. No one better. If Landecker sounded different than every other jock, it was by design. He insisted that his microphone be turned down and the music be turned up. My mind started reeling, engineer Al Rosen recalls. For one thing, no DJ had ever told me to bring his voice down before. And second, it did sound amazing. When John did an introduction over the intro of a Chicago record, his voice was actually just a little lower than Peter Cetera's. It did put him inside the music, and I think that was a subliminal part of the Landecker show sound. The 70s were a golden age for talent at the Big 89, too. There were no rivalries because each personality was unique and respected, encouraged by great managers like John Guerin to let his or her creativity flourish. I haven't worked at a radio station before or since that had the kind of camaraderie we had at WLS in the 1970s, Landecker writes. It was like one big nonstop party, especially in Bob Surratt, the afternoon star who preceded him. Landecker found a kindred spirit. On the air, we treated the radio station as a tool for our amusement, recalls Landecker. We would show up on each other's shows unannounced. There was nothing phony about our on-air kidding around. Everyone genuinely liked each other. The toughest nut to crack among their colleagues was Larry Lujak, the morning legend. Soon after he arrived from WIBG in Philadelphia, Landecker made the mistake of declaring in a jock meeting that he didn't think Elvis was that great. Lujak, a huge Elvis fan, glared at him. You don't know anything about music, you Philadelphia f***. Fast forward 5 years later to the day Elvis died. Landecker, who was at the station when the news broke, was sure the Elvis-loving Lujak would want to know. So Landecker called him at home. Who cares? Lujak growled into the phone. I'm taking a nap. While the mass quantities of alcohol and drugs Landecker ingested must have taken their toll, changes in the radio landscape were even bigger factors in his decision to leave WLS in 1981. By the time up-and-comer Steve Dahl signed in to host afternoons on WLS-FM, Landecker already had an offer from CFTR in Toronto. It wasn't about Steve, Landecker writes of his parting. It was about a company that had spent years telling me things had to be done a certain way. Suddenly doing a complete 180, with yours truly on the wrong end. I felt betrayed. I was hurt. Extremely upset. Though he was out of the market less than 3 years, things were never the same for Landecker when he returned to Chicago at the end of 1983. Calling it his descent into darkness, his stints at WLUP, WAGO, WCKG, and back at WLS were, for the most part, unhappy and unsuccessful. While my ratings were descending, my personal life was too, he writes. By this time, I was drinking heavily, and when I say heavily, that's not an exaggeration. One day I showed up for work with a full bottle of vodka. I was drinking openly in the studio, right out of the bottle. After a detour at WPHR in Cleveland, and a brief role as talent agent working for notorious con man Saul Foose, Landecker landed a morning gig at WJMK in 1993. A lengthy part of the book covers his 10-year stint there, no doubt because his loyal and talented executive producer at the time, Rick Kempfer, worked closely with him on the memoir and published it through his Eckhart's Press. Kempfer coaxes his former boss to tell just enough about the wild and reckless days, including the cocaine-fueled threesome that lasted a whole weekend, to be racy without being lurid. But the most revealing passages are those in which Landecker confesses his guilt as a less-than-ideal father of two daughters. My drugs and alcohol did heavy damage to my family and my relationship to my children, he writes. I put my children in many appropriate situations. I expose them to parts of life that are not for kids. I can only try to be a better person today. I have an 8-year-old granddaughter who has never seen me drunk, and I love her to death. Whatever parental DNA I've got left will be passed on to her when needed. As forthright as he is about his sins, Landecker doesn't go out of his way to call out others. I'm pretty sure I know the apoplectic program director who threatened to fire him if he played the Dixie Chicks, and the spineless general manager who forced him to call and apologize to every listener who complained about his show. But I wish he'd have named names. Records Truly is my middle name includes a treasure trove of rare photos and personal mementos, along with a 30-page addendum featuring transcripts of his best bits, parody songs, and interviews. While official publication is set for March 28th, Landecker's 66th birthday, it's available for ordering online now at eckhartspress.com.
Uh-oh, uh-oh.
What is it? Oh, no! Boogie check!
Recently, the Pew Center for Research did a study on the media. Its goal was to look at news, but since it's impractical to break that out, we get a wide-angle view, a hard look at both commercial and public radio sectors. 9 years ago, the Pew Center found that local news had, quote, seriously eroded in recent years, unquote, with more stations that are, quote, not at all local, unquote. Then came the technology that lets consumers find news without waiting for the newscast, although they're not usually seeking out news from SiriusXM or online radio. Financially, Pew says satellite and online radio had better years in 2012, with a more positive long-term forecast than traditional radio. It says AM and FM radio stayed even with previous years only due to the estimated $142 million in political buys. Here's a troubling sentence. Pew says that new Nielsen study finds that, quote, after discovering a song on the radio, still the most popular way to find new music, nearly two-thirds of teens head to YouTube for future listening. Just over 56% continue to tune in to radio, unquote. Pew suggests that the investment NPR has made in digital is bearing fruit. It lost listeners on the terrestrial side last year, down 3% to 26 million. Even the number of unique users at NPR.org fell about 9%. But usage of NPR news apps may be making up some of that difference. HD radio did worse than ever, according to Pew. It found fewer stations are broadcasting in digital HD radio, otherwise known as IBOC, than in previous years. 2,048 in December of 2012, down from 2,103 that previous year. That's based on Pew's analysis of BIA data, and it deals with the number of stations not actually listening. But the Pew research is pretty tough on HD radio, saying it failed to entice listeners away from satellite, for example. In 2012, it was the first year since 2004 that more stations dropped their HD signal than adopted the technology. But here's another take on the IBOC digital radio situation. Can you handle the truth about HD? Bob Strubel offers a different set of facts for the Pew study. The Ibiquity CEO read yesterday's Pew Center headline, quote, HD did worse than ever, and has this response. We had a net gain in stations broadcasting with HD radio technology every year since 2002, when stations first began HD radio operations. Growing HD2, HD3 stations is even stronger, and broadcasters are upping their commitment with new HD radio features, such as artist experience, the ability to broadcast images like album art, which has been added to over 400 stations. For the record, on December 31st of 2011, we had 2,034 stations on the air using HD radio technology. A year later, that number was 2,048. The Pew study cites a drop from 2,103 to 2,048. More broadly, HD radio technology and our business have never been stronger. This has been exemplified by receiver sales. In 2010, our partners sold 1.8 million HD radio receivers. In 2011, the number was 2.2 million. Last year, in 2012, it was 3.9 million. That's a 50% annual growth rate, and we forecast similar growth for this year and the next several years. And as you have reported, we are working with every automaker to include the technology in their cars. Then Struble, now warmed up, gets to something that he's been preaching for years. AM/FM is the last analog medium which presents long-term challenges to broadcasters. HD radio technology, by improving quality, increasing programming content, and adding features and services, allows broadcasters to compete more effectively with many other digital entertainment and informational sources. Our business results confirm the importance of broadcast radio's digital upgrade. Many of you might remember meeting up with Bob Savage, who is the owner of WYSL in Rochester, New York, during one of the conventions, and he had something to say about Bob Struble's comments. He says, quote, "The numbers cited by Ubiquiti and the FCC database and the Pew study are all exaggerated," said WYSL Rochester, New York owner Bob Savage. He says, "Whether it's 2048, 2103, or a similar number, that includes a number of FMs, which have HD but have turned it off for a myriad of reasons, generally related to expense, wasteful power consumption, maintenance headaches, listener disinterest, and adjacent channel and self-interference." Ubiquiti's website has for a long time listed call signs of stations which turned HD off years ago. The numbers claim for AM HD are fantasy. The best information available on the real pop count of AM/HD operations is tabulated in real time by Canadian consultant Barry McLarnon at topazdesigns.com. Barry's most recent numbers are that 199 U.S. AM stations are using HD. But of those, only about 70% are broadcasting the digital stream 24/7 because of antenna issues. HD does not play well with most directional arrays. So the box score on AM is 130-ish. Digital daytimers, about 35 graveyarders with no appreciable nighttime coverage, and about 35 big signal clear channel stations with general coverage. Even here, particular field experience proves over and over that skywave interference blows away the fragile digital signals, so even 50 kW giants have a very limited digital coverage. And by the way, Savage is not done. The receiver situation is also hyped, according to Bob Savage. Most of the receiver sales represent factory car radios. Most marquees do not include HD as standard, instead including it as a pricey option package. And HD has generated an inordinate number of technical service bulletins with manufacturers such as BMW, Jaguar, and VW, with non-engineering car owners bringing cars back to dealerships complaining about the poor radio reception. The big problem appears to be mode hopping, flipping back between digital and analog, bad time sync between two streams, weak reception, and muted HD subchannels. In many cases, if not all cases, the fix involves simply defeating the HD function so that the owner can enjoy good old reliable analog, which sounds to most people as good as their digital. As far as non-car HD radios, the best comment I can make is, good luck. A tiny number of standalone HD radios can be found if you're persistent, not to say stubborn, at your local Best Buy. So what's your comment? You can comment on this story by calling us on the Action Line, but Tom at RTK Media would like to hear from you as well. Please write him at Tom, T-O-M, at RTK-Media.com. DXAudioService.com and let him know your thoughts on HD Radio and if it's good for you.
Here's an article written by James O'Neill in a recent Radio World News magazine. He says, September marked the five-year point since the FCC first allowed AM radio stations to keep IBOC exciters switched on after dark. Readers may recall I was there at The Listen in 2007 to find out how this added digital baggage would affect reception and listenability of stations that had previously been available here in the U.S. by skywave propagation. My November 2007 article concluded that nighttime listening post-IBOC was a mixed bag. Some stations were severely impacted by the wideband digital carriers transmitted by their neighbors, while others remained listenable. Some of the success in maintaining a signal with entertainment value depended on where stations were geographically located. If they were at right angles to one another, it was usually possible to reduce the digital hash by turning the receiver to null the offending carrier. Regardless, the commencement of nighttime IBOC operations did affect signals of several Clear Channel broadcasters to the extent that they were no longer usable. I still listened to Skywave Radio, though not as much as before nighttime IBOC, and decided to recreate my fall 2007 listening experiment to see if there had been significant changes. Some AM stations have abandoned nighttime and even daytime digital operations since then. 5 years ago, I simulated real-world listening conditions by using only consumer-grade receivers, a Sanjian CC radio and a GE Super Radio 3. Also, no outside antenna or other such reception assistance was employed. In the 2012 experiment, the equipment list changed a bit. While the Sanjian is still a sensitive and devoted receiver, somewhere during the last 5 years, its LCD readout partially failed, making it difficult to ascertain frequency settings. So the GE and its analog tuning scale became my mainstay receiver. Another change was in the addition of an IBOC-capable receiver, as these are still not cheaply and readily available, at least with AM tuning capability. I borrowed a digital receiver with digital tuning readout for the evaluation. This was a Radiosophy Model HD100 certified HD radio. Another addition was a homebrew indoor tunable loop antenna for boosting signals a bit and to allow me to more easily reject interfering stations. Changes in the listening environment at my remote country home have been few. This past summer, the Rural Electric Co-op replaced the 30-something-year-old 7.2-kilovolt power distribution system running past my home. If anything, the new system is quieter than the old. I spread my listening over several weekends in late September and early October. Just as before, I logged a goodly number of stations arriving via ionospheric bounce, finding some quite listenable and others submerged in digital hash. I did note that several stations that once touted HD broadcasting had fallen back to good old ancient modulation. I began at the low end of the dial, checking in first with Nashville's WSM on 650, and noted they were doing a great job of pushing out radio's longest-running show, the Grand Ole Opry, to both of my receivers. As the station has elected not to do IBOC even in the daytime, there was nothing to muddy the waters in terms of raised noise floor or a side attack on the station's New York City neighbor WFAN on 660. While WFAN does run IBOC from time to time, it shuts off the digital carrier during live sporting events to keep portable radio-carrying stadium fans happy. This was one of those nights, so I found no IBOC there either. The HD100 signals presence of a digital signal and impending decoder lock with a brightly flashing blue LED. When there's enough stable signal, the flashing changes to a continuous glow. I was encouraged when the blue LED on the HD100 began flashing, indicating the presence of an IBOC carrier. However, even after several minutes of listening and playing with both the receiver's external loop antenna and my tunable loop that was radiating into it, the best the radio could do was only blink its light. Digital lock was never achieved, no matter what I did. This went as far as detuning and physically removing my booster tunable loop just in case it was sucking out IBOC sidebands. Not likely, as the loop's Q isn't really that great, but I had to be sure. I momentarily checked in with Chicago's WSCR on 670. Decent signal. No IBOC light observed. Moving up to 700, I found Cincinnati's big one, WLW, wasn't so big anymore as it was being cut down to unlistenable size by IBOC splatter from the upper adjacent New York WOR. When I tried tuning to WOR itself, I got plenty of blue light flashing on the HD100 and for just a few seconds a solid lock indication. But before I could evaluate the station's digital sound, it was washed out by a Spanish-language co-channel transmission, most likely from Cuba. The next stop was at the dial position of another old friend, Chicago's WGN on 720. Unfortunately, just as soon as the ionosphere wrinkled a bit, it was blasted into the ground by WOR. I quickly moved up to the 740 slot, Canadian Clear CFZM, AM 740 calls home. This station does a very good job of sending a variety of music into most of Canada and the eastern half of the U.S. during nighttime hours. No IBOC dings here either, as the local adjacent Alexandria, Virginia on 730 runs very low nighttime power and gave up on IBOC some time ago. The upper adjacent, Atlanta's WSB, also seems to have thrown in the towel on IBOC. Detroit's WJR on 760, no IBOC, generally listenable, but not so its upper neighbor WABC. That 770 kHz operation suffered seriously from IBOC noise generated by Chicago's WBBM on 780. As the interference was so strong, I suspected correctly that BBM was skipping in with a monster signal, and I moved up 10 kHz to check this out. Bingo! Got a solid IBOC lock and just a taste of nighttime digital medium wave reception. However, this was not to last. In less than 30 seconds, the HD100's LED started flashing, and the decoding fell back to plain old AM. I stayed with BBM for quite some time, hoping for another IBOC lock, but it never happened. Another Canadian, CKLW, was there at 800 but wasn't listenable due to the hash kicked out by Schenectady's WGY on 810. GY itself was listenable on both receivers and triggered a flashing blue light but never locked up on the IBOC decoder. The station also handily took out Fort Worth's 820 WBAP operation. However, it was aided and abetted by upper-adjacent WCCO in Minneapolis, which was received well on the Super Radio, but didn't manage to produce a lock on the HD100. WHAS on 840 put out its usual nighttime signal, solid. Interestingly, the station touted HD operation early on, but 5 years later doesn't talk about it anymore. A little further up the dial, both WWL in New Orleans, 870, and WLS in Chicago, 890, were getting hammered hard by IBOC from New York's WCBS on 880. A longtime nighttime favorite of mine is Des Moines, Iowa's WHO on 1040. However, ever since Boston's 1030 WBZ added IBOC, WHO has suffered greatly down here in Virginia, and I'd written it off as non-listenable. On my first night of experimentation, that was still the case, BZ wiping out not only WHO, but jamming KDKA on 1020. Same old story with trying to decode digital, though. WBZ flashed the light, but never locked. On a subsequent night, though, I was pleasantly surprised to find both WHO and KDKA quite listenable. Either BZ had dropped its IBOC carrier that evening, or the received signal strength from Boston was so low that the first adjacents triumphed. I know that station-by-station reporting might be boring, so I'm going to stop and just highlight some of my listening experiences. I rapidly moved through the rest of the tens, as there's not much left anymore. KYW on 1060 has never done much here at night. There's a mishmash of co-channels on 1070. Hartford's 1080 WTIC doesn't do a great job of delivering the goods, and Baltimore's 1090 WBAL has been hammered into the ground by adjacents TIC and TAM 1100 ever since nighttime IBOC started. Things got a bit interesting when I hit the 1100s, however. Even though Cleveland's WTAM puts in a super nighttime signal here, all it could do was flash the IBOC light. Curiously, it still wiped out BAL, but didn't seem to touch Charlotte's WBT on 1110. Asymmetric IBOC sideband operation? Perhaps. Enough signal strength from BT to override the hash? I wish I owned a spectrum analyzer. The same sort of thing happened when I tuned up to 1120 for KMOX in St. Louis. Its signal pinged the blue LED, never locking, though. Lower neighbor WBT was fine, but KMOX did a great job of trashing the 1130 upper adjacent WBBR in New York. I witnessed this particular phenomenon on multiple occasions. It was always the same. Terrible WBAL, great WTAM, great WBT, great KMOX, terrible WBBR. Despite triggerings of the iBock lamp on many occasions, I only succeeded in getting a lock on the one occasion previously mentioned. Conclusions. The late John Battison once mentioned to me that he thought the HD in HD radio stood for highly disappointing. After my experimentation with the Radiosity receiver, I have to agree. While it may have some benefit to the handful of FM listeners who have equipped themselves with HD radios, I have to conclude that as concerns AM, it serves as nothing more than legalized jamming. I did observe in this latest listening test that at least some of the original iBock nighttime adopters had switched it off. I asked the transmitter supervisor of one of these 50-kilowatt operations, part of a medium-sized group, where the decision had come from. Group operations, CEO, station manager, PD maybe, and was told that it had been arrived at solely between himself and the chief engineer. Seems that when the iBock exciter was powered down, no one outside or inside the station complained. I also discovered an interesting website that chronicles AMHD operations, managed by Barry McLarnon. It's appropriately called AM iBock Stations on the Air, and will be interesting reading if you've followed me this far. The site indicates, as of this writing, that of the 307 AMs listed, 202 are currently running iBock, with about a third doing nighttime iBock. This site also provides information on when and sometimes why iBock ops were suspended. Here are some of the reasons. iBock said to be off due to listener complaints, off for live sports, off since ownership change, off since antenna rebuilt. It might be interesting to examine listener response files from these iBockers to see how many complaints were received when the HD exciters were powered down, or conversely, how many compliments were received when nighttime iBock ops were initiated. I suspect that the number of either of these responses is vanishingly small. Maybe it's time to give AM iBock up altogether. As witnessed, SkyWave-delivered iBock doesn't work. Perhaps the clears that persist in operating in that mode at night might want to think about applying for a reduction in power, as the only digital benefit would be to local listeners, and how many of these there are is highly debatable. At the 50-kilowatt level, the only thing these stations are accomplishing is jamming their adjacent brethren. If you've really got to hang in there with a digital signal, and I can't understand why, at least be a good neighbor and cut your power bill in the process. Daytime operation seems to be proscribed, too, by the very nature of the AM broadcast band. Modern technology, light dimmers, cell phone chargers, CFLs, etc., has injected a tremendous amount of man-made noise into the lower end of the spectrum. Witness the scramble by TV broadcasters to vacate the lower VHF channels during the digital changeover. You cannot decode a digital signal if it's blanketed by noise, period. And that opinion by James O'Neill, who is technology editor of TV Technology Magazine and a contributor to Radio World. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service.
I'm Charlie Van Dyke, and you're listening to the DX Audio Service from the National Radio Club.
Bed is rickness. See sun and shine.
Hey, DX Audio Service members, if you try to get a hold of me in the month of April, it might be a little bit hard because I'm going to the National Association of Broadcasters convention, and as soon as I get back from the convention, I'm hopping in the truck with Debbie, and we're headed up north to the UP of Michigan, across the top of Michigan, through Wisconsin, Minnesota, over to North Dakota, and then we're coming back down through Chicago, and we'll be gone probably for about 2 weeks. That makes 3 weeks. I'll be out of the Sheetrock announce booth here. So if you try to get a hold of me, don't panic. I'll get your call when I get back, but don't expect it to be returned within a short time. Now, I'll try to take email with me, but who knows how that's going to work on the road. So just chill, and we'll see you in May.